Hello, and welcome back to another episode here on Authentic Spoon Nutrition. I'm your host, Tess Keatley, an accredited practicing dietitian and nutritionist. This podcast is for anyone who's interested in learning about nutrition, business for health professionals, and also this year I'm changing things up and having authentic conversations with people who I find really inspiring. So on today's episode, I would like to welcome Stephanie Velarquez, also known as The Dietologist. Steph is an accredited practicing dietitian and nutritionist based in Sydney, Australia. Her digital practice is focused on the health and well-being of women and men before conceiving, and more recently she is focused on the diet and endometriosis after receiving her own personal diagnosis herself in 2019. Steph is helping women reduce their pain, say bye-bye to bloating, and enhance their fertility through expert dietary advice. You can find more about Steph's services at thedietologist.com.au, and you can find Steph on Instagram at the_dietologist, and also her new Instagram page, which focuses on endometriosis, which is endo.dietitian. So if you haven't gathered already from the title of the podcast, today's episode, I'm going to be picking Steph's brains about all things women's health, including PCOS, endometriosis, fertility, and also male sperm health, which I think is really important and not spoken about enough. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Welcome, Steph. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tess.
No worries. Now, I'm just trying to remember the first time we ever met. I think we originally connected on social media, like most people who I've had on this podcast. But I think we officially met in person at Dietitians Unite, maybe a couple of years ago.
Maybe it was Dietitians Unite last year, or maybe was it the Dietitian Connection event that in last October?
Oh, Food Setters.
I'm having... Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Sorry, that's
I'm having,
right.
Like amnesia.
Yeah.
yes, I think we've actually properly got to chat at that event.
Yeah.
But also we were both running around like headless.
Yeah, so. Definitely. I was working at both of them too, so I was probably like in work mode and then trying to be. Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were working too. That's right. I remember.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we get into it, I've just got a question that I always ask foodies or dietitians. If you could only eat one food for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
This is so hard. Probably hot chips.
Yeah. With gravy or sauce? Salt?
No, I just like them plain. I get intense sodium cravings.
Yeah.
And I'm a sweet tooth, but it's very infrequent. But when I get them, it's like the most satisfying thing when you get your hands on some hot chips. So
now I feel
hot
like
chips,
them.
The grilled ones with the herbs on them. That's my fave.
Yeah, now you've set me up for some serious cravings. I might have to get that for dinner tonight. Cool.
Sorry.
Well, obviously your name's Steph, and I'm gonna let you pronounce your last name because it's a hard one.
It's Steph Velarquez.
Okay, there we go. Is that Greek? Is it?
Yes.
Yeah, good. I'm good.
Yeah.
Good today. On it today. So tell us a little bit about your background. So obviously you're a dietitian. What led you to study dietetics?
I wanted to be lots of things when I was young. I went through a phase where I was really good at, I was like that annoying kid that was good at debating and public speaking. So I thought I'd be like a lawyer or like a politician at one point. It's really funny, in high school people used to call me president or prime minister because I was school captain. So I used to get like all sorts of weird politician kind of versions of my name. Then I thought I'd go into media and comms and do journalism. I was really interested in that for a bit. Wanted to be a doctor at one point, and I really wanted to be a pediatrician. And so I started looking into it, and I was like, whoa, that seems like a commitment. And I don't feel like the lifestyle I would like to have really aligns with that. So I let my very best friend from high school pursue the medicine career, and I just went to university open days, and I didn't even know what a dietitian was. Like, I knew what a nutritionist was, but I'd never come across a dietitian ever. And so it was probably year 11 that I went to the university I ended up studying at, which was University of Sydney, and I just started going to different kind of lectures mainly in the science field. I knew I wanted to go into science, and dietetics just like clicked. Like when the head of school presented the Masters of Nutrition Dietetics, I was like, oh, that's a job. Yeah. I was like so stoked. I was like, food, I'm obsessed with food. I never did food tech or anything like that. It was very sciencey, but I didn't appreciate how much science was in food until obviously later. But I felt like it was like a food doctor, right? Like yeah. That's what I interpreted that career as. And so I was like, this is amazing. Like it seems like a better lifestyle than medicine. Sorry to anyone who's in medicine. Yeah. It's not a dig. It's just wasn't for me. Yeah. And yeah, pretty much I committed in year 11, year 12. And yeah, I got straight into a combined degree and went straight into it. So
yeah. So you went straight out of high school? Into it?
Yeah. I was 17 when I started. Wow. As the baby.
What areas have you worked in post-graduation?
Yeah. So I actually really struggled to find work after graduating, which I think I've done some teaching at my alma mater. And students would get surprised by me saying that. I've had the pleasure of actually like presenting on my career journey despite it being so short thus far. They kind of wanted a kind of recent grad experience, and I think people were surprised, like knowing where I am now, that I once struggled to find work, which I think a lot of newly graduated or soon to be graduating dietitians can probably relate to. I think I did probably like 60 applications. I did 13 interviews before I got a yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the first yes was a part-time practice role in a physiotherapy clinic mm-hmm. that was looking to kind of expand their disciplines. So I worked there part-time, and then I was trying to find other during that time I was also like working on my blog. I rebranded, so I had a student dietitian blog called Dietitian to Be. Most people don't know that, but I had a
really I didn't know that.
Crappy WordPress blog called Dietitian to Be, and I only ever posted like the blogs on my personal Facebook and personal Instagram, and I never had a proper page. But I was like, you know what, I'm gonna relaunch. I can't be Dietitian to Be anymore, like dietitian now obviously doesn't make sense. And so I relaunched as a dietologist, and I was working on my blogs all the time. I really consistently post once a week on there. And then I was trying to look for another part-time job. And so I found a second part-time job in private practice as well, but as a contractor at a psychology practice that was becoming multidisciplinary as well in a pediatric role. So I was mainly working in quite severe feeding issues with children,
mm-hmm.
which... like I said, I thought I was always going to be a pediatric.
Yeah, I was going to say, there you go. You kind of have a little bit of a taste.
Yeah, and that was exactly what I wanted. So I didn't know how easy or hard it would be to find a pediatric private practice role, but I really liked private practice, so I wanted to go into that kind of field. And so I kind of worked basically 5 days all up between those two part-time jobs. And then the end of 2018, so I was probably in that physio role for almost a year, I quit and I decided to go solo in my business. Yeah. So at that time I also picked up work with the A2 Milk Company as a food industry consultant, and so I was becoming a little bit more confident that maybe I could go into business on my own. I didn't think I would do it so early in my career. I thought I would spend more years getting experience and all that kind of stuff. So I've only exclusively worked in private practice, but like as a traditional dietitian,
mm-hmm.
but I do food industry consulting. I do obviously social media, blogging, have my own podcast. And so I guess I've become kind of and I've held research roles as well. So I've had research positions, part-time as well. Yeah. Doing some clinical work. So I think I've dabbled in quite a few areas, which I've really enjoyed, but it's also helped me decide what I enjoy most, because I enjoy all aspects of it, but then it helps me it does help me eventually get to a point where I'm like, this is what I like the most. I'm going to dedicate more time to that.
Yeah. A couple of things you said that really stood out to me there was when you graduated, you know, it was difficult to find a job straight away. And I feel like that's something that's not really spoken about a lot of in dietetics. Like, I know people think that the job market is quite short, but people don't actually understand how hard it can be. So if there's any students mm-hmm. listening here and you're 6 to 12 months out and you still don't have a job, that's actually normal. And as hard as it sounds, it's, just keep sticking at it. And the other thing was, did you decide to leave your role because you wanted to just exclusively start your own business, or was it more of like you wanted to write your own course?
I got out of it under, like, I was kind of cryptic about it at the time because I didn't really know what I was going to be doing. And so a lot of things were happening in my personal life at the same time, and I felt like all the chapters were closing at the same time. It just felt like a good time to, like, cut it all off, pare it all back, and actually, like, start a business, like, properly. Like, I did hardcore research. Like, before I started my social media page, I did so much professional development on how to be social media dietitian and what that looks like. I did dietitian connection webinars by, like, Rebecca Gawthorn and Leanne Ward on social media and dietetics. I did, like, everything that I could do, I did it. And I was very much like that in my first year out. I probably spent, I don't know even how much money on professional development, like probably 10 grand just on PD that first year. And people were like, oh, how did you get to where you are so quickly? I'm like, spent a lot of time and money and energy working on it in very early parts of my career. And I'll continue to do that, of course, but I had the time then to really invest because I was working 2 part-time jobs and I had the time. So absolutely, it takes a while, and it's got nothing to do with your marks either. Like,
definitely. Like,
the top students in our grade still struggle to find work. It's just the way it is. Like, your marks are, of course, like, do your best, but it's not going to be the defining feature of your job prospects.
I can speak from personal experience there. I was a terrible student in terms of GPA. So I guess that brings me to my next question. And what piece of advice would you give to someone who wants to start their own business?
Start before you're ready.
I like that.
You'll never be ready.
If you keep putting it up.
Like, even for me, like, I did in a way start before I was ready, but even still, I felt like I was playing small for a really long time. And probably more recently I've kind of let go of that and started playing big, and it's totally scary, but definitely pays off. Start before you're ready. You know, like, there's going to be people out there that say, oh, you know, you should really work for someone for 3-4 years, or you should do this, or you should do that. The word should just be eliminated from the vocabulary when it comes to, like, careers, because everybody's journey is going to be unique and different. And whether you start a business the day after you graduate, or whether you start a business 10 years on, from my networking experience, same. Like, I haven't seen, like, worlds of difference being made. Sure, you'll have heaps more clinical experience under your belt, but depends on what type of business you're going into. That might not even matter.
And depends what you want to do too. For sure. So do you have any role models in the dietetics or business space that you really look up to, or did look up to when you were starting?
Melanie McGrice was probably one of the biggest ones. I was doing her webinars, like, again, at that time when I was, like, entertaining the idea of leaving and starting my own business. I was, like, devouring private practice kind of PD. And Melanie was one of those people that stood out in the niche that I wanted to go into in a private practice capacity. And it's crazy because I, like, with dietitians I look up to, like, I almost feel, like, starstruck. Like, it, like, makes me, like, when I meet them in real life or they like acknowledge I exist, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how I felt like. And so I went to Melanie McGrice's course a couple years ago on fertility and pregnancy nutrition. And that's really when I completely changed my practice into that niche. And now I am part of Nutrition Plus, which is a group of dietitians that all focus on early life nutrition, which is run by Melanie McGrice. So pretty crazy to think yeah. like the person that I looked up to probably the most is like my mentor now, which is
yeah.
like,
that's so funny. Amazing. I was actually thinking, I was like, you might say her actually. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
She's not the only one.
Yeah, yeah.
She's definitely one of the someone. Big ones. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I really resonated with what you said because Marie Ferguson was obviously mine and then I ended up starting to work for her. So definitely a starstruck moment for sure. What's some of the challenges that you face with running your business now? Apart from sleep deprivation that we spoke about earlier.
I'm getting better at that. Time is never, there's never enough hours in the day is my current challenge. I feel sometimes you can get on a hamster wheel of having to please everybody and cater and spoon feed to everybody, which is really hard for you because you're one person. And whilst, you know, it might look like there's a huge team of people behind that Instagram page or website or, and absolutely, it's not just me, you know, like there's so many people I call upon to like make my business run the way it does. Nonetheless, like there's no one more invested committing more hours than me, right? Mm-hmm. So the last 3 months I've made the joke several times to clients, my boyfriend, family members, like if somebody could clone me 3 times I would be forever grateful because I am struggling.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah,
so I probably, and you know what, it's really funny because I haven't said that to everybody and a few people have actually like come and said that to me.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you probably need a few more of you to like yeah. get through what you really need to get through. And I'm like, I'm aware. So yeah, I think that's been the toughest part. And at the moment I'm struggling a lot with the decision to change systems and things like that, like business systems and streamlining those things. So yeah. That's my current challenge.
Yeah. I feel like I can definitely relate to you right now. Before I hired Joanna, my partner Zach was like, oh, so who are you looking for? Like, what do you want? And I said, I literally just want another me. And it's funny because Joanna and I joke about it now that we're very similar. I'm like, all right, my little twin. I think I've actually tried to hire myself, which is kind of weird and arrogant, but it's working. So it's hard there when you've got a personal brand. Tell us a little bit about your business then. So I'm sure the listeners probably picked up you work a bit in fertility. So is that some of the main clients that you see, women especially?
Yep. So when I first started out, in my business, I was seeing women with reproductive health concerns, so dominantly PCOS and endometriosis, but there's always other things that pop up in there, lots of irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. And then I really was passionate about fertility nutrition, so I saw quite a bit of fertility nutrition, but I also was equally as trained in pregnancy and PED, so I would still see pregnant women and pediatric clients as well.
Yeah.
But now, as I've gotten busier, my ideal client or my niche has gotten tighter. So now I pretty much only see women in the preconception period, whether they're trying to conceive unassisted or are pursuing IVF or other kind of reproductive assistance. So yeah, that's pretty much who I see now. I do have a few, like, I'll often post on my Instagram stories, like, who I'm seeing for the day kind of thing. People are always surprised, like, oh, I didn't realize you see pregnant women. And I'm like, well, often when a client gets pregnant under your care, they just want to keep going.
Yeah, like, they follow through.
They don't want to change dietitian at that point. So often I see, you know, even into postpartum breastfeeding and even into peds, like, seeing their kids and that's really nice, but I guess I don't I don't advertise that, but I absolutely can do that. But yeah, I've started a new account at endo.dietitian on Instagram. And so my ideal client is becoming more and more a woman with endometriosis who's trying to conceive. And that's off the back of getting my own diagnosis of endo and, yeah, just attracting so yeah. many women who live with that condition and its comorbidities as well, one of which is infertility, but there's also lots of other problems that come alongside endometriosis that diet can help enhance the management of. So
yeah, definitely. I was going to ask what led you down the path of women's health. Was it your own diagnosis as well, or was it just more that natural progression from being interested in peds and then slowly working your way?
Yeah, it was from peds and going backwards. So when I studied science at uni, I studied a lot of microbiology. And so I was across the gut microbiome back in probably nearly 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And so we were talking about C-section versus vaginal delivery and how the vaginal microbiota populate the baby's gut bacteria and how that's different for a Caesar versus a vaginal delivery and how that programs like epigenetics. I studied so much genetics at uni. Like I never went down, I was listening to your other podcasts, you guys talking about anatomy. I never did any anatomy or stuff like that. I did physiology, but I did a load of micro, right?
Yeah,
like I was
wow.
obsessed with micro. And so, yeah, I just was fascinated by it. Like the soil bacteria and all that stuff, couldn't
yeah.
care less. But you tell me about babies and how their whole life is like potentially determined by their birth modality. I'm like, whoa,
yeah,
we've got so
new
evidence now
hey.
To suggest that that's not as important as we used to think. But at that time, that's what we thought, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of started backtracking from peds because I was like, oh, preventative health, you know, getting with the kids. And then I was like, hang on a second, it matters what parents are doing in their pregnancy. And then I was like, hang on a second, like preconception is where it's at. And
yeah.
that's really when I fell in love. And on a more personal note, I guess I tell people this only now, but deep down, I don't know, even as a child, I had this idea that I would struggle to conceive. I don't know why I ever thought this, I just felt it. I was even talking about adoption from like a really young age, like as something that I would pursue.
Yeah.
And nobody in my family has ever struggled to conceive. Like nobody has. And so I don't know where I got this idea from. Like
yeah.
I it wasn't given to me from like a media source. I just felt it.
Yeah, as a kid.
And I never really vocalized it because obviously when you tell people that when you're like 19, they think you're a nut. Like they're like, what
yeah.
are you talking about? Like, how would you know this information? And then, yeah, I kind of went on my own kind of reproductive health ping pong all throughout uni into my master's and beyond. I got diagnosed with IBS. I got diagnosed with an ulcer in my terminal ileum, which anatomy fact is not a normal place to have an ulcer, very bottom bit of your bowel where your B12 is made and all that good stuff. I pretty much checked out for every single test. I kept thinking I had PCOS. I cannot tell you how many tests I had for PCOS. So many. And always negative, like always negative. And I was like, I think I have endo. And I didn't know much about endo at that time. And it wasn't until last year when I was seeing my clients. And I just kept, I remember this distinctly, this one week I'd seen a gynecologist for another reason. And I said, do you think I might have endometriosis? Like I list off some of my symptoms and stuff. And he was like, yep, yeah, you know, let's just go in there. Let's just see, you know, it sounds like plausible to me. Let's go and check it out. And I was like, what? He just said, yes. Like I've been talking about this for 5 years and now somebody's saying, yes, what? And so I was scared because I was like, oh my God, imagine I pay all this money. I get cut open and I've made this up in my brain. I don't have anything, you know? And so I was talking to people, like I was calling my colleagues who were dietitians in endo. I was even asking my clients, like,
tell me what your symptoms are.
With my clients, you know? And so I was asking them, and one week in clinic, I think I had like a ridiculously high number of endo referrals at that point in time. And every single woman came to me that week and said, oh no, I didn't have period pain.
Mm.
I was just tired all the time. Fatigue was their main symptom, which is obviously the most difficult symptom to pinpoint to anything.
Yeah.
But when you rule out all like main causes, they're like, oh no, it wasn't until this and this happened that we put two and two together and we went in for surgery and now it's covered in endo. And I was like, oh my God, like this is a sign. Like I have to just go and do this. And so, yeah, December last year I was diagnosed with endometriosis. And yeah, it's just kind of changed my path a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying it.
It's crazy how you know in your own body when something's wrong. So I think we've spoken before, but I have PCOS and I think I found out when I was maybe 19 and I think I'd read something online, you know, how you Google your symptoms on Dr. Google. And I went to the doctor and I was like, I think I have this. Can you test me? And they were like, no. And then I went back. I'm like, please test me. Like, I think I have this. And yeah, it turns out I did have it, but you know in yourself when something's not right, hey. Like, you just have that kind of intuition feeling of...
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's why I wanted you to come on the podcast as well, because I still have so many unanswered questions in my own personal journey with PCOS. And as you mentioned earlier, it's frustrating because when I first got the diagnosis, the doctor was like, okay, well, you can go on the pill, or if you don't want to, there's nothing wrong and just come back and see me when you are trying to have a baby. And I was 19, 20. I wasn't ready to have kids, but I was like, surely there's something that I can be doing now to help myself in the next 5 to 7, whatever years it is. But they were like, yeah, no, go on the pill. It's all fine. When it wasn't fine, I had unexpected weight gain, serious acne. I couldn't sleep. I had anxiety, just a range of symptoms. And you know, I'd always naturally kind of been in a smaller body my whole life. So for me to gain weight was like, what is happening to my body right now? So for the next little bit, I'm going to pick your brains a little bit about PCOS for the listeners and maybe for my own personal gain. I really love how you do your Q&As on Instagram and also how you do your kind of, what do you call it, your research tips of the week where you pick an article and then you dissect it. Fabulous, because I hate reading and you just summarize it really well. But what's one of like the main questions that you get asked on your Q&As about PCOS?
They tend to be medical, so I tend not to answer them. Like,
yeah.
Can I conceive if I have PCOS? Like those types of questions, which aren't, FYI, aren't best directed at a dietitian, they're best directed at a gynecologist or fertility doctor, which there's some amazing fertility doctors who open up Q&As like on the Instagrams too. So like absolutely go check out fertility doctors on Instagram. But I think probably the biggest thing is at the moment and has been for the last probably 2 years has been gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free for both PCOS and endo. There's a huge, massive dietitian account that endorses, we won't name names, that endorses gluten-free or dairy-free, and dairy-free, sorry, for management of PCOS. And it's probably the one that grinds my gears the most because often I see clients doing it on their own, and you probably have similar experiences, Tess, in your clinic, but women are trying to do it on their own, trying this way of eating, thinking it's going to solve their problems. They don't feel any better, or B, if they do feel any better, they've created another problem for themselves, like a nutrient deficiency or fatty liver or something else, and the bone mineral density is suffering too. And there's some research to show that women with PCOS are at an increased risk of low bone mineral density, and something I see a lot in my practice, and I'm grateful to work with doctors who test BMD in women with PCOS, especially when they report dairy-free or low dairy intake. So we detect osteopenia 27-year-olds.
Yeah.
No problem. We're seeing heaps of that. And so I think it's really irresponsible to be giving this kind of blanket dietary advice that comes with so many risks. when there's no evidence to support, it's even going to help people. So if it works for you, that's great. I'm not discounting your experience, which is something I always say. You know, N equals one when it's your experience is the most valuable thing. I hear you, but that's not what science is, and that's not what social media is designed for. It's not for N equals one. It's not for one person's experience. It's not a personal recount. It's for sharing general evidence-based recommendations. As a dietitian, that's what I have to do. What I say on Instagram may not be what I say to you in a one-on-one session.
Yeah.
You know, things probably will be quite different. Mm. So, but you certainly won't hear me say in a session, yeah, absolutely, go gluten-free or dairy-free test if you've got PCOS.
Yeah.
That's going to solve the problem.
That's probably the number one question that I get asked with my online clients as well who have PCOS. It's like, but I heard I should go gluten and dairy-free. And I'm like, where did you hear that from? And I've tried to find copious amounts of research on it and the evidence just isn't there. Maybe we should actually explain what PCOS is for those who are unfamiliar. So do you mind sharing?
Yeah. So PCOS stands for polycystic ovary syndrome. In some countries, it's called PCOD, polycystic ovarian disorder or disease. I don't know. But sometimes I get questions from overseas and they're like, I have PCOD, and the first few times I'm like, what's that?
Yeah, what's the D?
PCOS is a syndrome, so it's a cluster of symptoms, and to be diagnosed with PCOS you need to meet two out of the three following criteria. The first is you have an irregular menstrual cycle, so either too frequent or more often too infrequent it tends to be. The second is you have clinical signs, so symptoms like acne, hair growth, hair loss, or biochemical signs of high androgen levels, which is called hyperandrogenism. So androgens are, I'll do air quotes for everybody listening, male hormones, but we all have androgens and we do need androgens as a female, but when we have excess, it can cause problems. And then the third one is polycystic ovarian appearance on a pelvic ultrasound. Now, the biggest misconception, probably the next biggest misconception about PCOS, is that the cystic appearance of the ovaries are actually not cysts. They're follicles. So they are going to be future eggs. And so the combination of high androgen levels, and often we know that a lot of people with PCOS also have higher rates of insulin resistance. That combination can make lots of follicles be kind of stimulated just a little bit. So it's kind of like all the seeds in the garden grow just a little bit, but none of them ever turn into that one flower. And that's really what needs to happen for ovulation to occur. And so that tends to be the preceding factor to end ovulation. So you only need two out of three. So technically, if you have acne and an irregular period, even if you have normal androgens on bloods, you can be diagnosed with PCOS.
Yeah.
And so interestingly, the criteria do not include your BMI, your insulin resistance, whether you have sugar cravings, which are all commonly reported symptoms of PCOS. But it's the last few weeks even I've had a influx of, you know, small-bodied women newly diagnosed with PCOS, and they feel frustrated because all the things that they're being offered to help manage their PCOS have been, here, take this medication used for insulin resistance, or here, do this to help manage your weight, and they're like, but I don't need to manage my weight.
Yeah.
Like, there is nothing to be managed. Like, how can you help me? Like, my androgens are normal. I don't, like, why is this happening? And so I think the important differentiation with PCOS is, to get a diagnosis of PCOS, you need to exclude everything else too. Like, you need to not have congenital hyperplasia, adrenal hyperplasia. You need to not have hypothalamic amenorrhea, which I have seen very often be misdiagnosed. So that's where you're not getting a period, often because of energy restriction or the hypothalamic. So there's an axis called the hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis, the HPO axis. If that's been shut down for too long, it might take a long time to re open again kind of thing and get those things firing. We see a lot in sport and also in eating disorders. We see a lot of HA. And so women who have HA and polycystic ovarian appearance on ultrasound get relegated to a diagnosis of PCOS, and they're told to restrict carbs when that is not what is going to help them.
It's so frustrating.
And so often I'm fighting with doctors being like, she needs more carbs.
Yeah,
like,
she needs to eat.
She needs more carbs to ovulate. And they're like, why is this dietitian telling you to eat more carbs? That's so irresponsible. And I'm like, because they don't have PCOS. Like, I mean, I'm not allowed to say that, but I can see it.
Yeah.
Like, I can just see it. And so I just tell clients, I'm like, try it for 4 weeks. Tell me how you go.
Yeah.
Usually 2 weeks later, I get an email. I ovulated. I'm like, uh-huh. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't surprise me. So, yeah, basically with PCOS, the biggest thing is I think it's the first diagnosis people are jumping to now, which is great. We've got awareness. That's amazing. But we need to rule out everything else.
Yeah. I feel like still there's so much gray area with PCOS as well because, like, I don't know, you might know a little bit more, but there's – it's been around for a while, but the research is kind of still new. Like, there's a lot still we don't really understand and know. You mentioned a little bit about insulin resistance. So how important is the diet for the management of PCOS?
In my humble opinion, it should be the first stop on your PCOS journey.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the guidelines, the international management of PCOS guidelines have changed to say that before you commence medication or the pill, you should be trying lifestyle interventions for at least a minimum of 6 months before you move to medication for the management of PCOS. Now, those guidelines published in 2018, so the uptake of them takes ages for guidelines to be adopted.
Yeah.
But from my clinical experience, I would say this, that is rarely happening.
Mm.
The first stop tends to be, here's metformin, here's the pill.
Yeah.
If they're not trying to conceive, or if they are, here's metformin, go see a fertility doctor.
I wish I could put like an applause when you just said diet, because that is like the one thing that's helped me with my management of it is diet and lifestyle.
Yeah.
How important
it is. It's so amenable to diet and lifestyle. Like, it would be it's a disservice to women to not tell them that, you know, and then they end up on Dr. Google and they end up doing some stupid gluten-free, dairy-free diet instead of just being pointed in the right direction from the get-go. And it just perpetuates the whole yo-yo dieting experience that I know many women with PCOS experience as well, which women in general experience, but I find especially women with reproductive issues much more susceptible to the kind of dieting.
Yeah, for sure. And I also feel like there's a lot of people who also have PCOS also suffer from anxiety and disordered eating because of that negative cycle of being told that they need to lose weight, they need to go on a restricted carbohydrate or restricted food group diet, and then it just is a vicious cycle as well. So working with a dietitian is so important, I think, for anyone listening.
Yeah.
So speaking of diet, what would be your top 5 nutrition tips for someone with PCOS?
See a dietitian would be the first one. I really think that is as important as getting a diagnosis is seeing a dietitian. It's like we wouldn't let someone with celiac disease get newly diagnosed and not see a dietitian. It should be that way with PCOS. And like, I know that's not a nutrition tip, but no two women with PCOS are the same. So like, the next 4 tips, they might be useful to you, but they also might not. And so that's the beauty of what we do. My second tip is to make sure you get lots of plant foods into your diet. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and whole grains as well, and prioritizing those. I focus a lot on this with all of my clients, especially those trying to conceive. The third would be, if you do eat fish, you incorporate oily fish a couple times a week. Omega-3s can help with insulin sensitivity and inflammation, which we know there's high rates of inflammation in women with PCOS. Also helps with your egg quality. The next one, if you're experiencing high androgens and you've got things like acne or hair loss or hair growth, there's been research to show that, especially for hair growth, so especially around your face or your back or your belly, for example, spearmint tea, 2 cups a day, has been clinically proven to help reduce that. We think it's a natural kind of testosterone blocker kind of effect. So that would be one thing to definitely look into. And the last one would probably be get your vitamin D status checked. Women with PCOS have really high rates of vitamin D deficiency, and if you correct it, it really can improve your overall management and enhance the other lifestyle factors that you're doing as well. So that's probably like the key things that I go through in like if I was just say whether no matter what size you are, like that would be what I would
Yeah,
discuss with you either
it's good
which way.
general. Yeah.
And then customize from there depending. You're trying to conceive, not trying to conceive, etc.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what bringing back to how you said about the vitamin D, another really important reason why you shouldn't exclude dairy from your diet.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people that get the diagnosis of PCOS generally are told to go on the oral contraceptive pill. And just before I ask this question, I'm not against the oral contraceptive pill, like it's a personal choice, but I do know there's a bit of research to show that certain nutrients can be limited when on it. So do you know much about this?
Yes, I know a lot about this. Well, I think I do anyway. So yeah, I'm totally on board with you. Like some people come to me, they're like, "Steph, I had to go on the pill." I'm just like, "Yeah, and like I don't judge you. Your contraceptive choices are for you. Like that's nothing to do with your dietitian, you know." But what is important is if you're planning to come off contraception, like if you're using a hormonal type of contraceptive, especially the pill. And you're planning to conceive or you're not, you may want to look into your diet and lifestyle during that transitional phase. Now, we have super old data, and in the world of research, we generally like new research. We like things like 10 years or less. We're like, yep, that's great. So this data is like from the 60s and 70s. So we've known this for ages, but I feel like when I found this out, like, no one was talking about it. I was shocked. I was actually appalled because so many, 1 in 4 Australian women at some point in their reproductive years will take the pill. It's a lot of people. And so the key nutrients that the pill could potentially deplete are zinc, magnesium, selenium, some of your B vitamins, including folate, very important if you're going to try to conceive, B6, B2, and B12. As well as vitamin C. I think I haven't missed anything there. That's just on top of my head. So I have a blog post on this. I have several podcast episodes on this topic. So if you want to learn more, you can probably check those out.
Beautiful.
But getting a lot of those, you can't test your levels of. So getting onto a prenatal supplement that is probably a little bit higher in some of those things might be a consideration if you, especially if you're planning to conceive after coming off the pill, and also looking reviewing your diet as well at that point in time. But we have heaps of, there's so much old research that shows us like the pill can alter different nutrient absorption, increase losses, and alter intestinal absorption. And we know that, you know, if women are depleted in some B vitamins, we have higher incidences of PMS and all sorts of other issues that are commonly reported. And I mean, it's a pretty simple fix. So, like, if that is part of your picture, like, it's a simple solution. And so I think it's absolutely a key consideration if you're
It's
coming off the
interesting
pill.
because a lot of those vitamins and minerals that you just mentioned are so integral for fertility. So, one last PCOS question. Are there any supplements in your experience that you think are beneficial for PCOS?
Absolutely. So obviously it's a conversation I have with people individually. It's really dependent on your background, medications, your bloods, all those things, you know, la la la, it depends, the classic dietitian disclaimer. But I would say what I'd use most commonly in my practice is inositol, omega-3s, vitamin D, cinnamon, and whether that be food or not. And then other things that I don't necessarily use, but there's research to support, is supplements like berberine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new paper that just came out about that review that I saw come through PubMed yesterday. Got that on my Research Wednesday list to do. So
I look forward to it.
Berberine and spearmint tea, which again isn't a supplement, but it's almost like you're taking it like a supplement. You have to take 2 cups a day and you have to take it every day. It's kind of almost like a supplement in a way. And then almost all the women I see with PCOS are trying to conceive. So a prenatal multi is what we're after. So they tend to be the most common things. There's some research looking into things like chromium, resveratrol, and certain antioxidants. But that's like we're going into minutia kind of research space. The practicalities are top ones are inositol, omega-3, vitamin D, prenatal.
Yeah. So prior to conception, how long before should women start either supplementing or making changes to their diet?
Sooner is better. At the end of the day, you carry your eggs as a woman from 20 weeks when your mum was pregnant with you. At 20 weeks, you started developing your eggs.
Wow, that's crazy.
And so you carry them from so your mum kind of carried half of your grandchildren, which is amazing. If you're a female, right? So at the end of the day, can't wind back the clock and take back, you know, those uni days of drinking too much and eating too many hot chips and all that kind of stuff, but you can certainly make changes moving forward. And so even if you're listening to this and you're like, ugh, babies are like 8 to 10 years away, you know, that's cool, but it doesn't discount like lifestyle changes can happen as soon as possible for optimal fertility. And that's actually what research suggests, is that we actually educate teenagers about nutrition for optimal reproductive health, like, and that we need to be changing what's happening in schools more so, especially about contraceptives and nutrition and things like that. But I would say if you are thinking about conceiving, a minimum amount of time is 3 months. A good amount of time is 6 months. If you have complex health needs, 12 months or more is ideal. I get the best outcomes with my clients who come to me about a year before they want to conceive, or like 9 months. Like, that's a good amount of time. If you need a change of body composition, we need time. So the more time the better. The cases that stress me out is like, yep, I've got IVF tomorrow. What can I do? I mean, I can help, but I don't know how much impact I'm going to really have, because this is how long it takes for an egg to develop. It's about 90 days to mature. Sure, we've been carrying them our whole life, but the last 90 days is when they're getting really big. And sperm cycle is 62 to 74 days, so looking at again about 3 months. So 3 months is ideal. 1 month is absolute bare minimum to be taking a supplement. If you are pregnant and you just found out and it was a bit of a surprise and you freaked out, just start taking something right away. And you know, like I said, you can never go back and change time, like change the past. So stressing about what you ate or didn't eat or didn't take isn't going to help you. So just start.
I'm glad that you brought up sperm health, because I can't wait to, and I've actually got here in brackets, throw shade at Zach so that he listens to this. So how, for all of the ladies listening, if there's anything I want you to take home, is to pass on the next message to your partners.
Yeah.
How important is male nutrition when trying to conceive? Because I feel like there's a lot of pressure on women to, you know, take this prenatal supplement, eat these foods, do this, don't do this, etc. And we forget about the guys. So can you shed some light on this?
Yeah. So for those who do have a male partner that you either plan to conceive with soon or one day, you're looking at, it's a 50-50 split, right? Pretty boring, but an embryo is 50% sperm genetics and 50% egg genetics. So if that sperm can't get to where it needs to be, can't fertilize an egg efficiently, there's not enough of them, or the DNA that is living within them is of terrible quality, as in it's broken, it will take longer to conceive. So 30 to 50% of infertility cases is male factor plus or minus a female factor. So about, we think about 30% is only male factor, 30% is combo male and female factor, and the remaining 30% is female only. So there is honestly no reason why women should be bearing 100% of the burden. Now, I think the reason why women do is because we are the ones in general who carry the baby, and are connected to it for the next 9 months if we are the ones carrying said baby. And so I feel like childbearing has always historically been a woman's role in society. And so fertility naturally becomes a woman's problem, but that's just not the case. So men need to pay attention to their diet probably just as much, if not more, than women, in my humble opinion, because if you have male factor, now there's a few exceptions, if your partner, husband, boyfriend has had testicular cancer, or has azeospermia, so there's no sperm at all, or variceals, things like that, those types of conditions, they're not really amenable to lifestyle. Just gonna be real, okay? Now you need medical intervention. But if you get getting tests back like low sperm count, low sperm concentration, poor motility, poor movement, poor DNA quality, that is all highly amenable with lifestyle. And so within a period of 3 to 6 months, you can absolutely turn sperm quality around if you pay a lot of attention to your lifestyle. So men should be worried about their fertility, not worried, aware of their fertility. Men should be willing to be tested at the exact same point in time as their female partner. And men should be actively involved in preconception care, genetic screening they do with their doctors, nutrition, exercise, all those things. We're having more and more research, and I think there will be more research that comes to light, that it's not just about the sperm anymore. We don't think it's just male fertility equals sperm health. We're starting to see that male preconception health and their diet in particular is potentially more indicative of a child's future risk of obesity than the maternal diet and or lifestyle factors. So we're showing that diets higher in refined carbohydrates and lower in protein are programming offspring to be to carry more fat tissue versus those who have a higher protein intake and a lower refined carb intake. Doesn't mean you should go keto or paleo or anything, disclaimer, but my point is it's more than just sperm health, because the sperm actually has a huge signaling role in the downstream effects that happen when it becomes a baby. It's not just, hey, get in there, fertilize and get back out. Like, that's not what sperm does. We oversimplify it. I think we oversimplify it for the men, to be honest, but we oversimplify it, and it's so much more complicated than that. So your habits do matter.
For sure. So you mentioned some factors that can influence sperm health, but what are some nutrients that you would generally, in an umbrella setting, recommend to improve sperm quality?
Fun fact, I don't know when this podcast episode's going live, but maybe by the time it's going live, I'm releasing my Nutrition for Male Fertility ebook.
Awesome.
And so I'm going to be walking through all the key nutrients, where to find them, and key dietary patterns and things to avoid as well from a lifestyle perspective, and deciphering what sperm tests even mean, which is a whole nother thing. So the top ones are zinc, folate, vitamin C, CoQ10, L-carnitine, vitamin E, lycopene, selenium. They're the top ones. Top of my brain. I might have missed a couple.
Just a quick shout out, Zach. There's not much of those nutrients in KFC, so.
Nah, sorry, Zach.
Bummer.
And also to my boyfriend, he's a KFC fiend too.
Yeah. That's so funny. Thank you so much for sharing all of that, your wealth of knowledge when it comes to all things fertility, PCOS, endo. I could pick your brains for many more hours about this topic. So where can we find you? What are your, what's your Instagram website?
So my Instagram handles, I have two accounts now. So it's @the_dietologist is my main account. And I started a new account called @endo.dietitian with T's, not a C. Just everybody take note of that. And my website is thedietologist.com.au. I have pretty much over 100 blog posts on there. So I get lots of DMs and I end up just sending people links to my blogs because I probably answered it in a perfectly written blog post.
I'll put that down in the show notes as well so people can go and learn more about, I think you had one on the oral contraceptive pill as well. Yeah. And then a little bit more about sperm health so we can do some call outs to that. But awesome, thank you so much. And do you want to just quickly give a bit of a shout out to your courses?
Yeah, sure. So I am in the midst of redesigning my offerings at the moment, so I am launching a new program called Get Pregnant with Endo, and it'll be a hybrid program of an online course, group calls, and one-on-one consults with me. And also my fertility program will continue, which is a one-on-one kind of program.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also got my four-week kind of self-study program, The Waiting Game, which I will be relaunching as a self-study program.
Cool. Well, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And I definitely learned something myself, and I'm sure the listeners would have as well. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tess. Great chat.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. It would mean so much to me if you could give this podcast a review, a rating, and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any future episodes. We'll see you next time.